Good evening, everybody. Shmuel Plotzker coming at you live from Gulf Manor Synagogue and at School of Jewish Studies in Cincinnati, Ohio. It's really a pleasure to be back again. Here we are in the middle of the Aseret Yemei Teshuva, very much in the thick of it. Hope everybody had a beautiful Rosh Hashanah. It was really a privilege to be able to be with everybody last week, very much on the eve. It was Mamash Dafka, the eve of Rosh Hashanah, the night before Rosh Hashanah began, the new year began. We chapter rein an hour, and we did some Zichronos, among them some of my favorite psukim, and then we, of course, ended off with a beautiful story of Shlomo Carbach. If you were not able to be there, that by all means try to access it. We did record it. And you know what? I'm told 17,000 people called in. Now, I hope that's true. That's an incredible number. I mean, that's basically as many people as can sit in Madison Square Garden, just about, in New York City. That's a lot of people, and obviously I am so flattered and thrilled that you guys wanted to spend an hour with me on the night before Rosh Hashanah. Hopefully it was time well spent. Certainly that beautiful story of Reb Shlomo was really one for the books. So by all means, go listen to it if you haven't already heard it. And my friends, we're going to get right to it. There's a lot here. We're in the second chapter of 1 Kings. We're in Melachim Aleph, and we are in Perek Beis, second chapter. And I don't know about you, but I've been watching some reruns of The Sopranos on YouTube, and this chapter reads like a Sopranos script. We're talking about clipping this one and trying to sanction a hit on that one and whacking this one. I mean, Carmine is going to get hit, and they're going to make a hit on Ralph Cifaretta. And you get the idea? I was watching some of that last night. Johnny Sack was insulted because his wife's honor was insulted. I mean, this is the stuff you read about that you watch on TV. It's, you know, mob-related. I don't want to, God forbid, I don't want to, you know, compare our greats to The Sopranos, but this chapter is one long whack. It is one long hit and clip, one after the other. And I'm going to get right to it. What we're going to do is we're going to read it in English so I can prove it to you, and then we're going to go back and we're going to unpack as much as we can in the time left. And as we're going through it in the English, we're going to try to raise some questions that we'll try to hopefully be able to address when we do it in more depth as we unpack it tonight. And as far as next week, it's going to be a challenge. I'm going to be on the road. I'm going to be traveling from Cincinnati to New York, and there's virtually no way I can actually stop along the way for a full hour and park the kids somewhere and go give a shiur. That's probably not going to happen. So next week, no shiur to the best of my understanding. There's just not going to be any way to do it. But the next week after that is Chol HaMoed. And Chol HaMoed, I'm going to be in New York. I'd like to give the shiur. I don't want to lose out on so many weeks. So maybe we can do some of the work next in 2 weeks' time. At all events, let's go to the English, and we will unpack a little bit later. Let's read a little bit just to get some flavor for what this chapter has in store for us. We did the first two psukim, I think, 2 weeks ago. Let's review them. So we're in verse 1 of chapter 2. So the days of David drew near that he should die, and he charged Solomon his son, saying, and I'm in verse 2, I go the way of all the earth. You shall be strong, therefore, and show yourself a man. Be a man. V'yisa l'ish, it says in Hebrew, be a man. Verse 3, keep the charge of God your God to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes and his commandments and his judgments and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn. And now I'm in verse 4. That the Almighty may continue his word which he spoke concerning me. This is David speaking, saying that the Almighty fulfill what he spoke concerning me, saying, quote, if your children take heed to their way, to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul, there shall not fail you, says he, says God, a man, there shall not fail you a man on the throne of Israel. If the children of Israel keep my way, then we will not be lacking for a man on the throne of Israel. Now, ki se Yisrael. Verse 5, moreover, you also know, this is David again speaking to his son Solomon, you also, now here's where he acts like, I guess, the godfather, okay? Now you also know what Joab, the son of Tzruiah, did to me, and what he did to the two captains of the host of Israel, to Avner ben Ner, Avner the son of Ner, whose tomb I saw when I was in Israel back in the day. They took us to the kever of Avner ben Ner, and we were learning Arabic at the time. Adiel, the Arab, you know, keeper of the house and cleaner-upper, we convinced him to teach us some Arabic. So we were learning some basic Arabic letters, and I was able to make out the letter. Well, of course, I saw the Hebrew first. And it said in Arabic, Keber Abner ben Ner. That's what it said. And I got it through, and I was able to actually read a very, very small amount of Arabic. And in all events, Joab, the son of Tzruiah, killed Abner, the son of Ner. And also, what he did to Amasa, the son of Yeser, whom he slew. So he killed two people, Abner did. And he shed the blood of war in peace. And he put the blood of war upon his girdle that was about his loins, and in his shoes that were on his feet. So again, for the sake of those who are coming in live, we welcome you. We wish you a healthy, happy new year. And of course, everybody out there in phone land too. And what we're doing right now is we're reading chapter 2 in the English to try to figure out how this is not like a soprano script. This is really going to be a very, very violent chapter. And all events, we keep on going. This is David on his deathbed speaking to Solomon, and he says, you know what Joab ben Tzruiah did to me. As Asher Asali, what he did to me and what he did to two captains of the host of Israel, Avner and Amasa. I mean, the criticism was, if you remember those stories, certainly in one of the cases, Avner looked like he was, you know, he had something hidden in his coat, but he was walking away, he was walking too, but it didn't look like he was in any way a threat, you know, physically to anybody. And suddenly he drew out a small sword and he killed Avner ben Ner when he was not at all expecting it. So for that, David really had it in for him. Of course, the question becomes, and the question is going to be throughout the entire chapter, why were these men not taken care of when they should have been taken care of? I mean, on The Sopranos, if somebody, like Johnny Sack, right, he hears a story about his wife being insulted. And she's a morbidly obese woman, okay? So there are levels of heaviness. And she's off the charts. He's very offended. Her honor's offended. He's trying to sanction a hit on Ralph Cifaretta. I can't believe I know these names. The point is, he does it right away. My question for us as a class and for the Mefarshim, maybe they'll talk it out, how come David did not bring the guy straight up immediately on charges, try him right there and then, let the chips fall where they may? We're talking about homicide over here. You got to let the halakhic process work its way out. I'm not sure I remember the reason why he hesitated back then. At all events, he's on his deathbed now, and he's telling his son Solomon, don't let that guy get away with what he did. And so I turn your attention to verse 6. You shall do according to your wisdom. He is, after all, 12 years old. Do according to your wisdom, and do not let his hoary head, okay? Lo sorei tzevaso. Don't let his hoary head, is how they put it in English. We'll get to that when we unpack the whole chapter back, when we retreat our steps. We're going to do the Hebrew original. I'm just going to lay a foundation in English. Don't let his head go down to the grave in peace. He can't go down to Sheol, Bishalom, in peace. And that was verse 6. Mrs. Brola, you got something for me? Go ahead.
I believe that there may be a couple of reasons why he didn't do it at the time. First of all, this was his general. And Avner, who could have taken down that role, is now gone. So he has to have somebody leading his troops that he can count on.
Can I interject just a second? Can I ask you a question on that? It's a good point. It's a very pragmatic idea Mrs. Burlow is giving us. That, listen, you know, that's the general. He needs him to fight wars. You never can get too many good men. You're a talented guy militarily. So, okay, so you got to just, you know, go with what you have. Of course, what that means, according to your pshat, Mrs. Berlev, is that he seems to be sacrificing, I don't know how to say this, is he sacrificing some sort of halachic process that has to be done, in the American law, lahavdil ben tumah latahara, there are statutes of limitations involved. You don't want people to forget. Testimony is only so, relevant. People forget things. They lose papers. They pass. They move away. And people are not available for testimony. So if the halachic process demanded that somebody be executed for a homicide, then that's what I would have thought should be done. Even if he's a good general, let the guy get his punishment, and he'll find somebody else. Want to speak to that?
Yeah, I wasn't finished. Also, this is his nephew. I don't know if his sister's still alive. We don't know what kind of family tangles there are. Plus, I don't know if he felt he had the political capital to do that at the time. And the other thing is, to answer to your point, not sure, because he whacked Avner for having killed his brother.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, halachically, he may have had been halachically justified in doing that.
Mm-hmm. Avner?
I believe that was his argument at the time,
mm-hmm.
was that, look, he killed, his brother, so he's getting revenge.
I see. Avner had killed Yoav's brother.
I believe so.
And Yoav is now getting revenge. And that's what you're arguing. Okay, let's think about that. Still in all, isn't that for the courts to kind of clarify? Isn't that for Sanhedrin, for Beis Din, Haggadah, I suppose, to sit down and try to kind of come to terms with how we deal with a homicide? I'm curious,
But then again, you're asking why David didn't act in terms of the courts. This is the justification that Yoav is giving him.
Mm-hmm.
Avner was not dealt with justice, so he took revenge.
I see. I hear.
My only comment is, I think something which I mentioned before, that a Melech Yisrael, a kosher king, and the prerogative to kill is a matter of his prerogative of Malchus, quite apart from the normal halachic Sanhedrin process.
How he dealt with Uri Achiti.
Right. My impression from reading over the narrative reports, not as at least cases that we know about, the famous ones that are recorded in Tanakh, that is how the Melech acted. He did not act as a Rosh Sanhedrin or anything along those lines.
He was super legal. He was
right,
above and beyond
right.
The halachic process.
Right. Now, I don't know how that figures in with the idea of not prosecuting by the legal process. I don't know even who was in charge of the Beis Din at that time. However, let's not forget that according to the way the halacha was finally codified in Chazal, it would be an extremely rare thing that any murderer or anyone else for that matter could be put to death by the halacha of the Sanhedrin process.
Uh-huh.
So if he could be killed...
You're saying that, please repeat that, you're saying that it's not clear to you that a murderer would have been put to death?
No, I'm saying it's clear that the chances of any particular murderer being put to death in that class would be very remote.
Very remote.
Right.
And could you please elaborate, if you know, why
yeah.
it would be remote?
Among the requirements to do so are, you have all the Sanhedrin and Makos, you have to have two kosher witnesses who saw it from the same vantage point. Someone had to have warned him. The general warning is insufficient. The warning that you are not to do blah, 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 this big murder. And if you do, you will get the following type of death penalty, or at least some sort of death penalty if you type. And the guy has to say Tosha Degiba within a few seconds of hearing the warning. I'm aware of this, but Alpha Pisa, notwithstanding that, I'm choosing to do it anyway. Okay? Just these are stop right there. Without any more of the stipulation of the rules, it renders any judicially imposed death penalty as extremely remote, almost theoretical.
Well, that's true. Isn't it fair to say that's true for a lot of Jewish cases of homicide in ancient times? You rarely had two kosher male witnesses who were seeing a sinful act unfold, and they run over to the perpetrator, the soon-to-be perpetrator of the homicide, and say, "Well, listen, I'm kosher, he's kosher, we're above 13, and we see a knife in your hands, you're running after somebody. This is not going to end up good. And if you wind up killing the guy in front of our eyes, just letting you know, we're going to testify against you." It was pretty rare in those days to have that, and it's just simply rare all around. So that's a question that I have. It's not just in this case, it just seems to be in almost all cases of homicide. It must have been rare for people to be killing other people in front of kosher witnesses and being properly warned by those two witnesses. That had to be a most unusual occurrence in general, is what I personally feel. At all events, that's one concern. The other concern would be, okay, let it be that this guy, Yoav, killed two guys, one of them, okay, it was Nekama, there was some sort of revenge, all right, I get it. But okay, there were no kosher witnesses. And let the king say, I don't want to do anything on my own. Let God handle this one. Why can't we say that David, on his deathbed, should have said to Solomon, you know something? Why don't we just let this go into God's hands? Why, you don't have to touch anybody. Keep your hands clean. Don't shed any blood. There's no revenge going on over here. I don't like what happened to me with Shimi ben Gera. We're going to get to that in a second. I don't like what Yoav did. But you know what? We'll let the Almighty figure this one out. Why did he not take, if we know, why did David on his deathbed not take that approach? Can we conjure up some sort of ideas? Anybody want to give it a whack? I hate to use that term. We're looking at chapter 2 in 1 Kings. It's really a Sopranos script. It's Solomon being told by David, you got to kill this one and that one and that one. And it's pretty dark stuff. And right now, David is on his deathbed telling Solomon, I want you to know that there was Yoav, and Yoav killed Abner, and also must have been Yesa, and don't let them go to their graves in peace. You have to take care of these guys. And my question for Rabbi Berlov and the class in general is, Rabbi Berlov said explicitly, kings and Jewish kings in antiquity, they would go above and beyond the halachic process, and that was nothing surprising. But my question is hundreds of years after Matan Torah, and I presume we have a Beis Din, and we have Talmid the Chachamim, and we have great ones, why, if you don't want to go the Beis Din route, don't. Then at least let God take care of it. What's with this wild, wild west kind of approach to Jewish law? I must be going crazy, because I'm reading the chapter. You have to read the chapter. As I said earlier, it's like Carmine sanctioning a hit on Ralphie. It's crazy. Why is David not saying, well, I'm leaving this in God's hands? Rabbi Berlov, you want to take a shot?
Yeah, right. Since I spoke up last, I was just scanning the Malbim, who indeed, I think he answers the question probably as well as anyone could. First of all, he emphasizes what I've said about that Dinei Malchus and Dinei, the Mishpat HaTorah are two separate things. The royal
prerogative,
exactly. But that was, I think what he's emphasizing that also, or he's understanding that David HaMelech did not explicitly tell Shlomo HaMelech to kill Yoav. If you look at the verse 6, well, what does he say? Oh, well, I see that it's not good. Because I was going to say, the Malbim says, and you should do according to your wisdom. So the Malbim seems
Keep
to
going.
Say, I know, that's a problem. The Malbim seems to imply that that doesn't mean that someone was fair to kill him, but to use his judgment about it, consider it.
You
but,
got,
but the second half of the puzzle does not help. Let me see if the Malbim says anything.
Oh, I see. Okay. What we're doing is we're reading it in English to get an idea, and then we're going to go back and unpack it for narrative sake. Mrs. Broad, go ahead. There is a footnote right there which can give an explanation that we can all live with. And I'm not sure if we should, you know, I guess, you know, I kind of raised, okay, I raised the question. So let's go ahead and, Mrs. Broad, did you want to speak it out since you found it? Go right ahead and do so.
Okay. So Rashi and Yalkut Shmoni talk about the fact that this was David's nephew, and so he still had to have his welfare in mind. So he said, don't let him die a natural death, since this will minimize his worldly punishment and cause him to fall into
purgatory. Sorry,
right. You know, a torturous purification. In other words, his Olam Haba is going to be compromised if he doesn't have punishment in this world.
So he's got to have a death in this world. He's got to get killed in this world
to
so
give him a kapara.
Right, so he can have a little bit less punishment in the next. It's certainly a rabbinic idea that the more you go through here on earth, the better off you are, arguably, in the next world. And I have a little joke about that, about the kid who goes up, the man who goes up to heaven, judgment day, God says to him, all right, let's take a look and see what you did over life. Oh, I know, God says, oh, I know, I gave you measles as a kid. So the guy says, yeah, well, I did it, you're right, I did have measles. And God says, here up in heaven, measles gets you like 2.5 months off of hell. You're only going to get 11 months of hell anyway. 2.5 months is a good amount of time. Guy's going, yeah, I did have measles. Yay, God. And God's going, okay, and also I noticed that I let you break your arm when you were 7 years old, fell off a bike. That's like a month. I haven't done it without an arm. It's a month. And guy's going, yes, I broke my arm. That's true. And then God says, and you had something wrong when you were 15 years old. That's 2 weeks. And the guy's going, that's right, that's 2 weeks less of hell. And then God's going, then I see you had a lot of good health ever since then. And the kid's going, please, look through the whole record. You must have hit me. Didn't you hit me? Why didn't you hit me? A whole different vantage point on life and pain and suffering and illness. And that, I think, is very representative of the rabbinic mindset as to how we understand judgment. Please, God, hit me here. Don't let me have to get hit up there.
Apparently my first reading of the Malbim, as I continue to stand further, is in fact what the Malbim really did say. And in verse 6, the Malbim says, therefore, quoting, do according to your wise judgment. And then the Malbim explains that you will see that it serves the need of the hour to punish him in such a way, quoting, Shalosa Reitzeva So Bishalom Sha'ol, that his hoary head, or whatever you want to say, will not go to the normal grave Bishalom. Then the Malcolm says, this is the key point, Lo Pokad Lahargo Tavka. Notwithstanding, I'm saying, what the words seem to be pretty clear about, the Malcolm still understands that David HaMelech did not command of him, Shlomo, to kill him necessarily. Rak shelo yered sha'ol b'shalom. Just that he should not go to his grave in peace, meaning ki ha'as nishenu be'eze ofen she'yer b'choch moso. That Shlomo should punish him in such manner as his wisdom will dictate. Okay? So you see, notwithstanding the second half of the Pasuk, the Malbim still feels that there was no direct command to necessarily kill him.
I see. Do something to this guy. You don't have to kill him, but just aggravate him, so that when he ultimately, thank you, when he ultimately goes down to his grave, he'll have had some aggravation from you. Okay? You don't have to clip him, but just aggravate him a little bit, is what the Malbim is arguing. Okay, hold that thought. And Rabbi Lev, are you using the English version? If you are, great.
Okay. No, Before Jan came.
Okay.
We can circulate
this around to the class.
English is the Sansino, the unholy Sansino.
That's okay. We hold it
in front of us. I mentioned the presence, many of us. It was like the Kala's register at Macy's or whatever store. Yeah. And we used to register in Rochester growing up in Orville's Jewish bookstore. We used to register like for the Sansino set, and all invited guests who wanted to would buy however many volumes they chose to.
Right.
Then later this was considered anathema in the strictly Orthodox world, yet they still have it here.
Yes, because we're a little bit offbeat as a shul.
However, now the Ralbim, which I had, this is the Mikros Kedolos edition, which includes the Malbim, and it's only Hebrew.
Okay. If you're using the English, great. If not, we would circulate it around to the
class. Oh, you mean as a thing? Right.
Thank you so much.
Right.
Okay. And Barry can look in with me. And here we go. We're back in. And like I said, we are merely reading the first chapter to get an idea as to the whole narrative. And then we're going to go back and do a little bit of unpacking. So that was verse 6. And the Malbim says, thank you, Rav Roloff. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to kill the guy, but just, you know, don't let him go to his grave in peace. I just want to let you know that when I see those words in Hebrew and in English, v'lo toreid seva so b'shalom sha'ol, and don't bring his head down in peace to the grave, bells go off to me. That means don't let him go die a normal death, because you can say it almost any other way. You could say, and give him a little bit of aggravation, okay? But no, he says, don't let him bring his head down to his grave in peace. Don't let him bring his head to the grave. Grave? You bring him in the grave thing? To me, that means death is involved over here. I may be wrong. The Malbim does not agree with me. There's nothing new about that. But when I see those words, I see it's just bells go off and going, oh my goodness, this is code talk for Solomon to whack him. But that's just me. Anyway, you'll see, he whacks him. And that's kind of why I'm saying what I'm saying. But go ahead, Mrs. Brewer.
Now, I was going to say is, but we do use an expression, he doesn't have a day of peace. Okay. I mean, you think about David HaMelech, the life that he lived. How many days of peace did he have?
One rabbi said he didn't have a single one. It's hard to know. He lived 70 years, but yes, he had aggravation all the way through.
Right.
A lot of
so,
it.
So I guess you could argue when you die, you're then at peace. But I don't know that being killed changes that part.
Mm-hmm.
So just to the other argument.
Go ahead. And now verse 7 in the English. But show kindness. Here's the contrast. Don't let this guy go down to the grave in peace. But show kindness to the children of Barzillai the Gileadite, and let them be of those that eat at your table. For so did they befriend me when I fled from Absalom, your brother. Truly, truly, this man was running away from his son Absalom, who rebelled, wanted to be the king. And then Adonijo, have I mentioned Adonijo? Here he comes. An incredible chapter. Poor David, he was just, constantly, nonstop. And so, okay, so show kindness to Barzillai, the Gileadite, and his children. Let them eat at your table. Verse 8. Okay, let's go back to the tough stuff. Okay, and behold, there is with you Shimi ben Gera, Shimi the son of Gera, the Benjamite of Bahurim, who cursed me with a grievous curse. Klolonim Retzet. He cursed me with a grievous curse on the day when I went to Machanayim. And he came down to meet me at the Jordan, and I swore to him by God, saying, I won't put you to death with the sword. That's what I said, David speaking out of Solomon. I said to Shimei, you know, I'm not going to kill you, even though you don't go over to a king willy-nilly, like that term, and say, oh, you miserable wretch, your hands are full of blood, why don't you get out of here? I mean, bad stuff, completely disrespectful stuff. David's calling it a klala nimretzet. Maybe we should look it up and see exactly what his words were. As I recall, he was accusing him of blood in his hands, miserable wretch, talk like that. Something you don't say to a king. And David is apparently still grieving it. He's just aggrieved by the whole thing. Came down to meet me at the Jordan, and I said to him, I swear by God, saying, I'm not going to put you to death with the sword. I'm not going to put you to death with the sword. Verse 9. And now, hold him not guiltless. In other words, those two negatives equal the positive. And therefore now, hold him guilty, for you are a wise man, and you will surely know what you ought to do to him. And you shall bring his hoary head down to the grave with blood. Okay, that's a little bit more explicit than the other one was. I grant you that. Where he says, Sheol. And here he says, with blood. Okay, that's about as clear an expression of a sanctioned hit as you can possibly ask for. Okay, I want you to go ahead and hit him, whack him. Okay? That's verse 9. We keep going. It's a long chapter. Many, many hits. These are your greatest hits. Verse 10. Now David slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. Now you would think that that would be like kind of like the end of all the possible, you know, whacks that might happen. No, I say to you, no. Watch what happens from here on in. I'm telling you, you're going to be stunned. You're going to be stunned. Verse 11. In the days that David reigned over Israel, 40 years. 7 years he reigned in Hebron, and in Yerushalayim he reigned for 33 years. Shlomo sat upon the throne of David, his father. Batikon malchuso ma'od. His kingdom was firmly established. Maybe we should bank those words for a second, because things are going to get done, and we're going to think, oh, you know, if he doesn't do stuff, maybe his throne, maybe his kingship will not be firmly established. What's the author Jeremiah telling you right now? Things are good. His throne seems to be ma'od. Vatikon ma'huso ma'od. His kingdom is very much established. Mrs. Burlap, what do you got on that? That shed any light? It doesn't make it add a question to us? What are you going to do? Why do anything now?
Because now he is firmly established. He has the political ability to kill these people that David HaMelech was lacking, because his kingship was not firmly established.
He had his supporters from the tribe of Judah. He still had some people who never maybe forgave him for the way things went down with his father-in-law Saul from Benjamin. How he usurped the throne. Who knows what people were thinking? And then you had Avshalom rebelling, and you had constant wars. I mean, the man was just put upon. And so he had his critics. Even in his lifetime, he may have still had some of those critics. Oh, you want to talk about this guy, Yichus? Oh, you should only know who he stems from. Comes from Ruth the Moabitess. Who knows if that wasn't still circulating around for who knows how long. We'll never know. At all events, we know one thing. According to Jeremiah, who wrote 1 Kings, his kingship was firmly established. Mrs. Burlap says, and that's what's going to give him the ability to do what he needs to do. My question was, not in the immediate upcoming scenario. I'm going to argue to you that if he has a firmly established throne, then he has a firmly established throne, and he shouldn't do anything or fear anything. I don't want to give it away. I want to read to you. Read with me. Everybody together. I mean, you just look in. I'm on verse 13. Look in. I'll do the heavy lifting. And Adoniyahu, the son of Haggith. Who's that? Well, that was the guy who rebelled in the first chapter. If you're coming to us fresh, either live or over the phone, in phone land, and we have lots of people calling in, then remember to look over chapter 1. We're in chapter 2. We're far away from chapter 1. Chapter 1 showed us the rebellion of Adoniyahu, the son of Haggith, who was also, his father was David, and he rebelled against his father. Don't forget that. So here comes Adoniyahu, and he survived the rebellion by this much. Shlomo cut him a break and said, as long as you behave well, everything's going to be fine. So Gaudiot says, okay, everything's going to be fine. If I behave, I'm going to behave. He goes back to his house. But apparently he gets word that there's a pretty girl circulating around the court. I guess there was a Twitter feed. Maybe there was some sort of Facebooking going on, or I've Simchis, or I saw you at Sinai, and he sees her face, and he's just smitten. And he says, Gavalt, I have to marry this girl. I need nothing more to know about, you know, what she does for a living. She doesn't have to, you know, a master's degree. I need to marry this woman. Watch what he does. Are you ready? Adonio, the son of Chagit, and also the son of David, came to Bathsheba, the mother of Shlomo.
His father's wife, in other words, right?
His father's wife.
Yes.
Right, we don't have a term for that in modern English, I guess.
Right, I guess not.
You would say...
His father's... and you wouldn't say... You would not
you say stepmother? I mean, if you have a listen, your father had lots of wives. You know, that would be your mother, that would be your sister.
Six women, at bare minimum, I think he has six wives. I don't know exactly what the term would be, but it's complicated. At all events, Bathsheba is the mother of Shlomo.
One of the seven times.
Right, could be. He approaches Shlomo's mother. Mm-hmm. Now, you could probably not find a better individual to approach when you've got a very touchy, sensitive thing to ask about, than the mother of the king. After all, she's the mother of the king. Did you hear me? And so he goes over to the mother of the king, and she says, Hashalom Baruch Hu, like the Hebrew once in a while. You coming in peace? After all, you don't know. The guy was trying to usurp the throne yesterday. Now he's approaching, knocking on the door, going, can we chat? She's going, are you here? Are you going to hurt me? Because there was a fear that they had. If this guy becomes the king, maybe they're going to kill me, says Bathsheba, and they'll kill my son Shlomo, because I think he should be the king, and I was told he was going to be the king. And to get rid of all pretenders, he's going to kill me and my son, Oybe. So meanwhile, now Shlomo's the king, and for real, and she's going, wait a second, you have a knife underneath that gown? So he says, no, everything's fine. He says, peaceably, I'm coming for Shlomo. I'm here for peace. Okay? He's truthful. Verse 14. So he said, we got to talk. I have something to say to you. So she says, well, go ahead and talk. What do you got? Verse 15. So he says, you know that the kingdom was mine. Well, that's something to say. Something to say to the mother of Shlomo, because the kingdom was yours for like a half hour. I mean, how long was the kingdom yours? For like a day? You had people running in front of you? You had a barbecue? How long did that last? And before they knew it, you know, she was running, walking up. She approached the king. How about you? You know the kingdom was mine, and that all Israel set their faces on me, that I should, all Israel set their faces on me? I thought the whole nation was with Shlomo. Maybe truth is a little bit of a sticking point with this guy. I mean, I don't know else. You know that the kingdom was mine, lady, and you know that everybody was on my team, that I should reign. But you know what? The kingdom was turned around, and it's become my brother's, for it was his from God. So at least that's truthful. God gave it to him, so it's his. Okay. Excuse me, verse 16. And now I ask one petition of you. Don't refuse me. So she said to him, well, talk. Stay on. What do you got? What do you want? I mean, what can I help you out with? 17. So he says, speak, I beg of you, to Solomon the king, for he won't refuse you, that he give me Avishag the Shunammitess as a wife. I want Avishag the Shunammitess, Hashunamit. I want her. I want to marry her. Now, who is this woman? This is like the human blanket. I mean, I hate to use a vulgar term, but I mean, I don't know how else to say it. She was like keeping King David warm when he was cold. This is what Scripture says. I didn't write this. Jeremiah wrote it. I read it. I read it, and we will try to figure it out. And sometimes we do, and sometimes we don't. And over here, he's asking to marry that girl. That's what he's asking to do. That's the whole request.
I said, where was Abishag now? In other words, what says to him that Bathsheba would even be in control? Was he just supposed to be a shadchanis?
Yes.
Now the matchmaker?
Yes.
Did she have any shalita, any control or power over.
All I can say is I don't know, because nobody will. But the only guess I have, what's prompting him to go to Shlomo's mother? She is the former wife of the late King David. She knows all the court intrigue, and most importantly, her son is sitting on the throne. Who is possibly with that girl right now? Maybe Solomon. Maybe not. Who knows what the status of this woman is? Was she married to David? No, she wasn't married to David. Because this is really, I saw this ahead. I cheated. I prepared. I prepared the material. Watch this footnote. It comes up. According to the rabbis, the only one who seems to have known with any certainty about her status is Jeremiah the prophet. And he's writing the book, and it may be a little bit later. Obviously, things have to take place before he can start recording everything. So who knew at this particular point in time whether she had been married to David or just a good friend hanging out with him, keeping him warm, okay, and just chilling and cuddling? I don't know who knew. According to the rabbis, only Jeremiah knew. And he knew that she had never married David, that she never knew him.
Jeremiah or Bathsheba?
Only Yirmiyahu. They say only Yirmiyahu knew her real genuine status. As a Navi, only he knew what was really going on. And that's what he recorded in the previous chapter. He never knew the girl. How could Bathsheba have known? How could she have known what's going on behind closed doors? How could she have known that? I mean, maybe he... Who knows what's going on? How could she know with certainty that she was or was not married to David, that he had taken her or not taken her as an Ish Lakish? How could she know with certainty?
Because
according to the rabbis, only Jeremiah did. Barry?
Her appointed place was the treasurer. She was the treasurer.
So she could have known what's going on.
No, that girl was the treasurer.
Oh, that girl was the
treasurer. If she was a wife, she wouldn't have to be a treasurer.
Uh-huh. So you're saying that people might have known.
Being as she was the treasurer, she had a specific job. So therefore, they figured, okay, so that's what her job was. So she was the treasurer.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the midrash or is it not the treasurer?
Yeah, doesn't it say that? That's what they told everybody, that she was the treasurer, so she could come and go.
Well, all I know is what I'm reading over here. It's a creative, answer. I don't see that over here. At least not just yet. I didn't see that. I just saw that Jeremiah was this prophet. He's the prophet, the author of the scripture, and he knew with certainty her status. If she had been married to David, then the argument is just no way that she can then obviously go to David's son. That's not going to happen. It seems that Adoniyahu is banking on this idea that she, as Barry is saying, that she's serving as a treasurer or some other status, some servant, but not as a married wife, and therefore she's available. And in his mind, he must have reported, what do men do? Who's that pretty girl? You know anything about her? Yeah, tell me more. Well, she's not married. She never was. To David. Oh, okay, then if she was never married to David, then she's free and open and clear. Her title is open. His real estate is available.
Yeah,
right?
What makes you think she wanted to marry him?
I don't know anything about that. All I know is that he wants to marry her. And he is a handsome prince. So, maybe she would be interested in marrying him. All I know is she's available. Adoniyahu approaches Solomon's mother, and he asks her to be the shatkanit of Abrolov.
Now that I'm thinking, I'm going to suggest that, the official line was obviously there was something that went on between David HaMelech and the Bisha, right? However, there's probably a lot of rumors. Probably the gossip columns of the day probably had plenty to say on the subject. So I'm suggesting whether Abishag really knew or didn't know.
Whether
Adoniyahu
knew or didn't know.
No, I'm saying whether Bathsheba knew or didn't know. Adoniyahu, who might have respected his father to the extent that he believed the official story, but he needed somebody closer to the situation, like a wife. True, she was one of several, right? But at the same time, there's more of a chance that one of the six wives, right, that he had, would be able to really ascertain what the relationship there was between any other woman and their husband, mm-hmm. As opposed to anybody else. So that's perhaps why he wanted her as a shadchanit, she could squelch it if it was not appropriate right away, you know, as opposed to pursue it.
Right, and so he's doing what people do today. They get a hold of somebody inside and they make the request. Let's keep going. So he says, say I beg of you to Shlomo the king, he's not going to refuse you, that he give me Avishag the Shunamit as a wife. What's her response? Her response is, Tov, good, you spoke well, you're coming to the right person. I think I can make this happen. I think she's available. Maybe she's interested. We don't know. But we can always ask the individual who's really the mover and shaker, the king himself. And I have great access to the king. He's my son. Okay? So, she's good. I will speak for you to the king. So in her mind, everything is firing on all cylinders. Not a ridiculous thing to request. It makes some sense. I have access to the king. I'll present it to him. Verse 19. So Bathsheba came into King Solomon to speak to him for Adonijah. And the king rose up to meet her and bowed himself to her. And he sat down on his throne. And he caused a seat to be set for the king's mother. And she sat at his right hand. So far, so great. Verse 20. We're moving this along because of the time. Verse 20. So she said, Shlomo, I ask one small petition of you. Don't refuse me. Okay, so she's being very clear. I have something to request. Don't say no. That's something to say to somebody else. I'm going to ask you something, and don't say no.
Why don't say no?
Don't say no. Don't say no.
Somebody else.
You never know what the request is. And watch what Solomon says. He says, Mommy, not to worry about anything. Ask on, my mother, for I won't refuse you. So she says, don't refuse me. He says, I won't refuse you. Good. So far, everything is really looking good now. Because she knows information, and she's got this request, and she's going to get Shachanis Gelt, and man, this is going to be great. She's going to be Meshadach Zion, King David's son, Adonijo, with Avishag, who's kosher and available. Givalt, this is going to be a great wedding. Handsome couple, and they're going to be the first family. All right. It's going to be great. The prince and the princess. So verse 21. So she says, let Avishag the Shunammitess be given to Adonijo, your brother, as a wife. That's what she says. Let it be given. Let it be given.
Okay.
Let it be that she
be given.
Yeah, you tannis Avishag. That is the thing that it's masculine.
Okay.
Talking about a woman.
Right.
But okay, let it be the case. Let it be given that she should be given over to him. That's how she expressed herself. We get it. That your brother, and she says to him, your brother, she's referring to Adonijo, the rebel, he's your brother, and he's asking that this young lady be given to him as a wife. That's the whole request. What do you got, Barry? Anything?
Yeah, off with his head.
Wait, don't steal my thunder over here. I still have a few minutes over here. Here we go. Now watch what King Shlomo says to this seemingly innocent request for a shidduch. And he said, don't refuse me. I won't refuse you. I don't. Everybody's asking, don't refuse me. Okay, I won't do it. And watch. Verse 22. So King Solomon answered and he said to his mother, and why do you ask Avishag the Shunammitess for Adonijo? Ask for him the kingdom also, for he is my elder brother. And to him, and Evyatar the priest, and Yoav, the son of Tzruya. Now, I don't know about you, but I smell a lot of sarcasm over there. Okay, it's difficult maybe to write it any more sarcastically than you hear it over there, but he's going, oh, I can almost like, you know, hear his voice. Oh, he wants the girl, right? Well, why don't you go ahead and also ask for half the kingdom, lady? Why isn't he asking for all the kingdom? How about also portioning it out with the other two rebels over there, those wretches who are trying to do me in? Why don't you ask for the whole Malchus? Only asking for one girl? That's how I hear him through the words. And right or wrong, that's how I'm hearing him. So keep going, and I think I'm going to be vindicated. Verse 23, and still get you out of here in time. And King Solomon swore by... Now, this is incredible. So now Shlomo is swearing by God. Now he's really tying his own hands. Okay? So Shlomo swore by God himself, saying, God do so to me and more. This is classic biblical talk. May God do by me and even more. This, everybody uses this. Everybody uses this. They used it in Ruth's time, and they're using it in Solomon's time, and all the, keep going. God do so to me and more also. If Adoniel has not spoken this word with his life, he just asked for something, and now he's going to get clipped for asking for the woman.
See, this is the Malbim. The Malbim was saying that a death penalty for we're talking about now, Adoniel, right? Was not inevitable. He was very close to it. He deserved some serious punishment, but not necessarily a death penalty. But this just put him over the top.
Put him over the top. Thank you. And the footnote, as you see right over there on page 23, I'll read it right now. Thank you, Rebbe, because you quote the Malbim, so we'll give you the Malbim right now. This request is going to cost him his life. Shlomo is convinced that Adoniel would never endanger his life just to marry Avishag. Most likely he had other designs in mind, such as making use of the king's scepter as a beginning of sovereignty. Okay. He was trying his best to get a foothold in the court, in the mind of the Malbim. Solomon is thinking, this is just getting a toehold, if you will, and it's going to only be bad from here on in. This is not what I envisioned when I told him to behave himself and not do anything silly, stupid, or rebellious. He is clearly going over the top asking for that girl. There's no way that Adoniel thought he was. This is a man who didn't want to get killed. He was screaming, shrying Chai V'Kayim, if you remember last week. Oh, don't kill me. Oh, please don't kill me. And Shlomo says, I won't kill you. Just behave yourself, and I won't kill you. So a month later, the guy says, you know, I think it's time I get killed. I think I got to just commit suicide over here. First things first, how do I do it? How do I commit suicide? How do I get Solomon to kill me? All right, I'll ask for Avishag. What kind of talk is that? Do you think that this guy wanted to get killed? Do you think he said... how is Shlomo going to interpret this? He's going to interpret this very badly. Oh, that I'm clearly trying to insinuate myself back into the kingdom. He couldn't have thought that. Nobody wants to get killed.
I think he did.
Yeah, you think? So he goes to Bathsheba. He says, "I come in peace. Can I have a shidduch at least?" So she says, "Tov, it sounds good to me. I'll ask my Zimbala." So she goes to her son, and he says, "I gotta kill that guy." What? The whole thing is so preposterous. Does anybody besides the Malbim, does anyone want to say anything to me? What kind of talk is this? Oh, I'm thinking that maybe this is going to be the beginning of something terrible. Adoniel didn't see it like that. Bathsheba didn't see it like that. Nobody normal would have seen it like that. Why is Shlomo seeing it like that?
Maybe because he tried to go through Bathsheba and have Bathsheba ask for him rather than going in
directly.
Wow, you're thinking that it was actually a demerit or some kind of wrong action or mistake, fatal mistake for approaching Bathsheba.
Because, you know, that's like trying to get in the back door to get what I want. That indicates trying to be sneaky as opposed to just coming forward and say, "Hey, I really like that girl. Can I have her?"
Interesting theory that instead of using that shot for meat, he should have just gone into open court and said, "Anybody here available? How about that one? Is she available? She's cute." And he didn't do that, and you're saying that this spoke a certain kind of a sneakiness that Shlomo really
interpreted. Going through the back door through Mom, who's got the most power over the king.
I wouldn't have. Okay. I mean, something's going on inside Shlomo's head that nobody else is reading. So maybe you're right.
He's reading it very simply that she belongs to his father. That this shows that he's
that's what Bathsheba should have said to him. She should have said to him, "You know something? You may not be aware of what's going on, but you know they were a little bit close. Okay, they weren't married, but you know how it is." and people associate the two of them. So why don't you go find some other pretty girl? It's a big country.
Why do you, what makes you think that she figured that out? I mean, everybody else figured it out. She didn't figure it out. That's why he went to her.
Okay, he went to her, and she, I would have thought that a woman who was married to King David would know everything that's going on and all that. Let's keep going. We're trying our best to sort it out. We may never be able to, but our theories are interesting. I thank you all for them. We keep on going. 24, so now as God lives, and now he's really bound himself good, God who has established me and set me on the throne of David my father, and who has made me a house, as he has promised, that Adonijo shall be put to death this day. He's going to get killed today. So we're sanctioning a hit, okay, on Adonijo. Verse 25. So King Solomon sent by the hand of Benayo, Ben-Yehoyada, and he fell upon Adonijo. So Benayo killed Adonijo. You got to keep all these ahus, you know, clear. Benayo, who was Solomon's right-hand man now because he had been David's right-hand man, Solomon orders the hit. And Benayo whacks Adonijo. Sorry to make it so soprano-ish, but that's what's going on. He fell upon him, Adonijo, who died. End of Adonijo. It's over. He asked for the wrong girl as a shidduch. Are you listening out there, people in Solomon? Be careful who you ask to marry. Two, be careful who you choose as your shadchan, okay? You have to take all these things into consideration. If you have a guy who is king of Israel, and he can take a vow by God Almighty, and then find somebody to do the deed, you may be finished. You got to be careful out there. Shidduchim, it's a rough parsha. Here we go. Verse 26. And to Eviatar the priest, who had been with Adonijahu, he had been aligned with the baddie, the rebel, who's now dead. To Eviatar the priest, the king said, go to Anatot, to your own fields, for you deserve death. But on this day, I won't put you to death, because you did bear the ark of God before David my father. You were zaycha to hold on to the Aron Kodesh, or whatever. You came close to it, had a hand in this. And because you were afflicted in all where my father was afflicted. So I'm cutting you a break, he says to the priest, you're not going to die today. So he escapes the clip. Verse 27, so Shlomo banished Eviatar from being priest to Hashem, that he might fulfill the word of Hashem, which God spoke concerning the house of Eli in Shiloh. And that, of course, goes back to the very, very beginning of the book of Shmuel, the book of Samuel, chapter 1 in 1 Samuel, talking about how Eli's sons were not behaving properly, and God laid down a curse on the whole family. And so this is years and years later, and God is, that curse is still out there, and Shlomo is being Micaiahist. He is fulfilling the word of God concerning Eli in Shiloh, because apparently Abiatar descended from that family. Verse 28, and the tidings, the news, the shmuis, from which you get the word shmuz, okay, and the shmuot, the time the news came to Yoav, for Yoav had turned after Adonijo. Yoav was also a military man. He had been with Adonijo, the rebel, okay, and after Avshalom, he did not turn. He wasn't part of the Avshalom rebellion, but he was part of the Adonijo rebellion, okay, so he picked the wrong horse in the Adonijo affair. And what does he do? Well, just what everybody else does. He also runs to the altar and holds on to the altar. Does this sound familiar? Yes, Adonijo did it himself. He ran to the Mishkan, to the Ohel Hashem, and he goes to the Mizbeach, and he's holding on to the horns of the altar. And as I said weeks ago, it sounds like in the movie about Samuel Beckett, Thomas Becket, and then there was one was a movie called A Man for All Seasons, and one was Lion in Winter. I saw these in law school because they were law related. England 1100s, England 1300s, fascinating stuff. So one of them, I remember going to the church and holding on. Oh, no, nobody's going to kill me in a church. Guess what? Okay, don't fool yourself. People will kill you anywhere. So he goes to the tabernacle of God, and he took hold of the horns of the altar. Verse 29, it was told to King Shlomo that Yoav fled to the tabernacle of God, and behold, he's by the altar. And so Shlomo sent Benayo, who's already whacked one guy. Okay, so he sends Benayo, the son of Yoyada, saying, go, fall upon him. Kill that guy. 30, so Benayo came to the tabernacle of God, and he says to Yoav, thus says the king, come on out. Say, get out. And he said, Yoav says, no, I'm going to die over here. And Benayo brought back word to the king, and he said, this is what Yoav said. He answered me, no, I'm not going to come out. I'm going to stay here, and I'll get killed here in the tabernacle. Verse 31, so the king said to him, do what you said. Fall upon him, kill him, bury him, that you may take away the innocent blood which Yoav shed from me and from my father's house. And God shall return his blood upon his own head, that he fell upon two men more righteous and better than he. Remember, right? Amasa and Abner. And he slew them with the sword, and my father didn't know it. Abner, the son of Ner, captain of the host of Israel. And he also killed Amasa ben Yeser, the captain of the host of Judah. 33, and their blood shall return upon the head of Yoav, and upon the head of his seed forever. But upon David, and upon his seed, and upon his house, and upon his throne, there shall be peace forever from God. Verse 34, we're just reading now, just to get a feel for the narrative. So Benayo, the son of Yada, went up, fell upon him, killed him, and Yoav was buried in his own house in the wilderness. 35, the king put Benayo, the son of Yada, in his place over the host. In other words, he installed him as the general. And so that the priest, the king put in the place of Eviatar. So he's putting his men in to places which had to be replaced. They were open positions now. One guy is away, one guy's dead. So now he's put his piece of the puzzle in. Verse 36, the king sent and called for Shimei. Ah, Shimei, the guy who had cursed David and said, you lowlife scoundrel, you don't deserve to be the king. Get out of here, you lowlife. Okay, so this is what Shimei had said. And David says, don't let that guy go without punishing him. King sent and called for Shimei. And the king, Solomon, said to Shimei, hey, you know what? Build for yourself a house in Jerusalem and dwell there and don't go forth here or there. You're not allowed out. House arrest. You can't leave Jerusalem. Build yourself a nice house and stay in Yerushalayim. It's a nice city. Plenty to see and do. Every day you can go to shul. Every day you can go to the Beis Medrash. Every day go to the Kotel. Plenty to see. Walk around the old city. Ashuk here. Ashuk, it's very nice. But you can't leave Yerushalayim. Because look at it, won't leave Yerushalayim. You know something? There are people who never left Yerushalayim. That's a slight exaggeration. But you know what? It's the holy city, and some people see no reason to leave Yerushalayim. Where are they going to go? And Lot? I mean, where are you going to go? You and Yerushalayim. So he says, okay. So he cuts a deal. But this is Solomon still talking. Verse 37. So it shall be on the day that you do go out, and you pass over the Kidron Valley, you should know for certain that you're going to die, surely. Your blood will be upon your own head. You're going to die. You leave Yerushalayim and go over the Kidron, I'm coming after you, and I'm going to have the right to do it. Because that's the condition. Verse 38. So Shimei said to the king, it's good. Tell him about the bar. I like it. The saying is good. Your stipulation is good. Condition is good. As my lord the king has said, so will your servant do. Shimei dwelt in Yerushalayim many days. Verse 39. So far, so good. 39. And it came to pass at the end of 3 years that two of Shimei's slaves ran away to Achish, the son of Maacha, the king of Gat. And they told Shimei, saying, you know what? Behold, your slaves are in Gat. And that's, I guess, off in the on the Ashkelon coastline, maybe. It's in the, wherever it is. Is it on the, Gat on the coast?
Because it's one of these Gat. Guys.
It's on the
name Plishtim. It's just that he pushed him.
Okay. Yeah, right away. Gat is right away. Okay, it's like 10 kilometers in. From the water, at least according to this, to the map. Okay, so he goes to Gat, and they told Shimei, you know what, your slaves are in Gat. So Shimei arises, he gets up, he saddles his donkey, he does what anybody else would do in the 1850s, he goes after his slaves, okay? And he goes to Gat, to Achish, to seek his slaves. Shimei went and brought his slaves from Gat. Okay, the slave owner wants his slaves back. 41. But it was told to Solomon that Shimei had left Yerushalayim, and he went to Gat, and he had returned. Oh, this is not good. 42, so the king sent and called to Shimei. He said to him, didn't I make you swear by God And didn't I warn you, saying on the day that you go out, and you go over here or there, you know for sure that you're going to surely die? And you said to me, fine by me, dude. The word is good that I've accepted. 43, so why have you not kept the oath of God and the commandment with which I have charged you? And the king said to Shimei, you know all the wickedness which your heart knew secretly that you did to David my father, and God shall return your wickedness upon your own head. 45, and King Solomon shall be blessed, and the throne of David shall be established before the God forever. 46, and the final verse, and the king commanded Benaiah, who else? The son of Jehoiada, and he went out, and he fell upon Shimei, and he died. And the kingdom was established in the hand of Solomon. So if you think that it was firmly established 30 verses before, now it's really established. Everybody's dead. Okay. I mean, I don't want to be, you know, too crazy about it, but that was one dark chapter. Okay. Now you either can move on from there or we can unpack it. Because there's a lot of murdering and killing going on. Anyway, I'm not murdering, we'll just call it killing. I want to wish everybody a good rest of the week. Have a very, very edifying, uplifting Shabbos Yom Kippur. Everybody should be zaycha to a Yom Adin that's appropriate, and you should be Gemach Zimatov, you should be inscribed and sealed in the Book of Life for this year in the best of health. Next week, I'm on the road to New York, so the live class cannot meet, and I doubt that we can actually meet even over the phone because I'm going to be driving most of the time. I can't do it. So how about we meet in 2 weeks, and we'll do a little bit of work. Probably the class would like me to do something not related to Malachim. So I'll tell you what. In 2 weeks, when we do meet over the phone, let's do something that's related to Sukkos, and it'll be interesting, it'll be fun, and we'll enjoy ourselves. We'll find something to talk about, and maybe Koheles, maybe this and that. We'll find something good, and we'll do it for an hour. You'll enjoy. So let's meet up over the phone, sheer enjoyment, people, in 2 weeks. Have a good Yom Kippur. Enjoy Yontif, Sukkos. We'll meet Chol HaMoed in 2 weeks from tonight. Everybody have a good one. Zayim Gedolim, Kol Tov, Shmuel Plotzker, signing off. Goflan Synagogue, School of Jewish Studies. All the best.